I'm your host, Jonna, and I'm here to welcome you to today's show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM here in Santa Cruz, and freakradio.org on the internet. And I'd like to start off with an announcement. This coming Sunday, Transitions Santa Cruz is putting on an event. It's a plum harvest in Watsonville at a plum orchard, and you're all invited to come pick plums. It starts at 12 o'clock, and we'll be out there in this plum orchard picking plums and sharing recipes for preserving plums, cooking plums, and should be a good time. So if you'd like to find out more, you can go to transitionsc.org, and I think if you just look for plum harvest in there, you should find the information you might need there. There's directions on how to get there. And I'll put a link to the information on my Facebook page, which is Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook. What else was I going to say about it? Oh, I don't know how many plums there will actually be. So you might just want to come and just have a good time with us and eat a couple plums. Don't know if everyone will be able to get a huge bag or what, but it's 12 to 5 on Sunday the 18th. So get your directions and come on down and join us. So for the rest of the show, I'm going to finish up playing in a talk that I played the first half of last week by Marion Nessel. It's called What to Eat, Personal Responsibility or Social Responsibility. And Marion Nessel is a professor at NYU and written lots of great books on food and nutrition and such. And here we go. I hope you enjoy the rest of this. Let's see. Doo-doo-doo. Here we go. Thanks for tuning in.
This reporter got the dean of the School of Nutrition at Tufts to explain that Fruit Loops was a better choice of a breakfast than a donut. And one of the people on my blog said, maybe the program should be called Better Than a Donut. And last week's Economist had this wonderful picture of this child with a heading, It's Practically Spinach. I mean, this is ludicrous and a source of great embarrassment. And you Tufts students, I want to hear about what's going on at Tufts. So here's the environment that we live in, where we have, you know, government, industry, and sometimes health and nutrition professionals creating an environment that encourages people to eat more than they need or want. Okay, that's on the obesity side. Let me say just a few things about, one more on this, just to let you know, this is not just American. I was in Panama in January, and I picked up this, Kellogg's is right at the cutting edge. Here's chocolate sweetie cereals in Panama with an endorsement from the Pediatric Association of Guatemala. This is a worldwide phenomenon. Okay, let me say a few words about food safety. Food safety's changed in the United States from when it used to be a problem of leftover Thanksgiving turkey and deviled eggs at church picnics. We're now dealing with the two most important food safety problems, I believe, which are food insecurity in the world, people not having enough to eat, and obesity and its consequences. But then we have these nasty microbes that we didn't used to have, many of them antibiotic resistant. We have chemicals that nobody ever heard of before that are turning up in our food, like melamine. And then these really weird animal diseases and the remedies for them, with antibiotic resistance becoming increasingly important in these microbial illnesses. And in the United States, just within the last 3 years, we have had an extraordinary series of outbreaks of E. coli or Salmonella, and these are toxic forms of E. coli or Salmonella. You don't want to get sick with either one of these. the spinach E. coli episode of 2006, from which the spinach industry has never recovered. Sales of spinach in the United States have never reached since the levels that they were in 2005. The pet food recalls of 2007 that I thought were such an incredibly beautiful example of a food system gone wrong. It was jalapeno peppers, but in the meantime, the Florida tomato industry was completely destroyed. And then this year, we've had peanut butter pistachios, and most bizarrely, because nobody could figure out how the E. coli got in there, Nestle's Toll House cookies. I'm not related. So we have all of the, what my conclusion from the pet food recall was that we only really have one food supply, and the idea of separating, the idea of that you have separate food supplies for animals, for pets, and for people makes no sense. We're all eating the same food, and our food supply is global, and that we're never going to have a reasonable food safety system unless we have a decent regulatory system, and that regulation is essential. That's my take-home lesson from all of that. And we know what it is we need to do for food safety. We absolutely know. There have been reports, people talking about it for years and years and years. We need one food safety agency. We need risk-based procedures. They have to be science-based. They have to be farm-to-table. And I would add to this that they need to be size-specific so that the rules and the regulations are not necessarily the same for large and small producers. We need standards, we need regulations, we need education as part of all of that. We're not going to get any of that. It doesn't look like. There's a lawyer in Seattle called Bill Marler who represents victims of food safety outbreaks, and he has sent a t-shirt with this logo on it to every member of Congress in which he's asking them to pass a meaningful food safety legislation before Thanksgiving, because he would like to see a decent food safety system. He's made enough money, and he doesn't want to see these people getting unnecessarily sick. My understanding is that Congress will not do this before Thanksgiving. They're not even considering a single food safety agency that combines USDA and FDA, and the bill that's most likely to pass just fixes the FDA. That'll be a help. But the story that I hear is it won't happen before the healthcare stuff gets done, and we may be waiting a while for that. One solution The Onion put forward. The Onion had a very simple solution to the food safety crisis. The FDA should just say salmonella's okay, and we wouldn't have any problems. I love The Onion. Now, I would be depressed about all this, except that I think we're in the middle of a food revolution, and it's really exciting to be in the middle of a food revolution. Here's what Alice Waters really looks like, if you want to, for those of you who weren't sure who that was in that painting in the gallery. We're in the middle of a food revolution, and you know, part of that food revolution is being fueled by Michael Pollan and his extraordinary work, and I particularly loved his letter to the farmer-in-chief in the New York Times Magazine last fall, in which he made three suggestions. Re-solarize the American farm, he's talking about energy there, re-regionalize the food system, put more emphasis on local and regional food, and rebuild America's food culture and teach people how to taste real food and how to appreciate real food. If you haven't read that piece, it's as good as anything else he's ever written. So I'm teaching food sociology this semester, and it's a course about food as a social movement. And it's like the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the environmental movement in a lot of ways, and in other ways it's different. And one of the ways it's different is in fragmentation. So we have the slow food revolution, but notice that these are in revolutionary terms. Food that's good, clean, and fair, good for health, clean for the environment, fair to the people who are producing it, and slow meaning tasting good and being eaten and appreciated. We have the healthy food movement. A group in Oakland, California, the Strategic Alliance, did a survey of nutritionists and asked them what they thought healthful food really was. And the consensus was that healthy foods were minimally processed, contained only natural, not added nutrients, didn't have anything artificial added. If it was animals, they were raised without hormones or antibiotics. They were sustainably produced, fair to the workers, and accessible and affordable to everybody. Seems like a good definition to me. I like it. I live in New York City, where we have a really unusual thing going on. We had a health director last year and the year before who was really interested in public health. This is real, and as a mayor who backs him up, this is astonishing. And when he left to become head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, he was replaced by somebody who, if anything, is even more interested in public health than he was. So we got a lot going on in New York, and New York City requires calorie labeling of fast foods that have more than 15 outlets, putting it in context of 2,000 calories a day. And for those of you who haven't seen it, it's worth a field trip. I mean, it's just extraordinary to see the number of calories that are in these foods, and it's having two effects. One is it's encouraging people not to eat so much, and the other is it's encouraging the producers of these foods to cut down on either the size or the ingredients so that the calories are being cut down. So this may have an important effect. Their latest campaign is called Pouring on the Pounds, and it is an anti-soft drink campaign. As the evidence accumulates that soft drinks are tightly linked to rise in body weight, it's become clear that the first thing that you do when you want to advise people about controlling their weight is to get them to cut down on soft drinks and juice drinks. The result of that campaign is that the Center for Consumer Freedom, which is a misnamed a public relations firm for the restaurant, alcohol, tobacco, and other kinds of industries, started putting these big full-page ads in New York newspapers, "You're too stupid to make your own choice about foods." These advertisements are targeted at personal responsibility, saying the big government has no right to tell you what to eat. You're an adult, you're an individual, you're responsible for what you eat. Don't pay any attention to this kind of advertising. One of those big ads, full page in the New York Times, must be between $80,000 and $100,000. And my guess is the New York City's campaign must be having some effect. So I see it as a hopeful sign. Part of the concern of the soft drink companies is that there's now a big push to start taxing them. And there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is the most prestigious medical journal, by a whole bunch of people who signed on to it, that both public health and the economy would benefit if the sugar-sweetened beverages were starting to be taxed. So we'll see what happens to that. We have the organic movement. And here again, it's in revolutionary terms, and here it's quantitative because you can count the money that is spent on organic food. It was up until 2007 when the economic crisis started to hit, booming in sales, and it's now leveled off a little bit, but people are still buying organic, and as more of these food safety things happen, people turn more to organics because they believe that organics are safer. Which I guess they are so far. I do a lot of traveling, and I was in Fairbanks, Alaska this summer, actually for quite a long time. And I visited an organic farm outside of Fairbanks. I thought that was amazing because Fairbanks is 200 miles north of Oslo. If you count, it's really far north. They have a growing season that's about 5 minutes long. But they have a lot of light during that 5 minutes, and it kind of makes up for it. And the people who were on this organic farm were not native Fairbankers. They were people who came from all over the world to work on that farm during the summer as part of internships or whatever that woof thing is. And so there they were. They were very, very happy campers for the summer. Part of the reason, part of the impetus for organics has to do with what's going on with genetically modified foods, which I know is a big issue at this conference. And this is the Department of Agriculture's latest figure on the adoption of genetically modified crops in the United States. Look at the numbers on the left-hand column, and you can see that between 60 to 90% of soybeans, cotton, corn, are genetically modified, and sugar beets are not on this list, but more than 90% of the sugar beets in the United States are genetically modified, all of which happened in the last 3 years. We have an interesting situation in the United States where you have no way of knowing this unless you read the Department of Agriculture's website or are tuned into this issue, because they're not labeled. And I was fascinated to be in the United Kingdom and to pick up this brochure at McDonald's and see that McDonald's is now telling its customers that it does not use any genetically modified food in any of its food products or in anything that it's serving. We know our consumers are concerned about genetically modified products or ingredients, and we reassure you that we do not use any in any of our products. I thought that was absolutely amazing. I also picked up a Reese's Nutrageous Hershey's cookie candy bar, which has a label on it, contains genetically modified sugar, soy, and corn. If they can do that in England, we could do that here. It wouldn't be very hard to do. I'd like to see this stuff labeled. Fairbanks also had a farmer's market. And here again, you can count. It's quantifiable. You can count the number of farmers markets in the United States and the increase over the last 10 years. And of course, the latest addition to that is what's happening at the White House, which I'll show you in a minute. I also wanted to show you some things about locally grown food. I don't understand what McDonald's is doing in Great Britain, but these are McDonald's trucks. One of them says, our beef is reared on British and Irish farms, locally grown. Our eggs are all free range and laid in one place, locally, Britain. So McDonald's has become this green entity. It's kind of weird. Locally grown, in Fairbanks, the Safeway advertised locally grown food. I thought that was kind of amazing. And actually, at New York University, we have locally grown food, and I told some of you about this. We have a gardener. I had no idea. There's no land, as you can see here. This is outside the building where I work. But he has 83 planter boxes, and these have beans in them. And he planted vegetables in all of the planter boxes that he could get his hands on this year, locally grown food. And also part of the new growing your own food movement, which is huge these days. And so I want to mention about truck farm. Have many of you seen the film King Corn? Yeah, which I loved. Oh, well, these are the guys who made King Corn, and they're now making a movie called Truck Farm. And by truck farm, they don't mean what you usually think of, where a truck delivers the stuff. They're growing vegetables on the back of a pickup truck in Brooklyn. The lower left-hand picture here, I mean, here they are. There's their truck, and here are the guys in front of my building in Manhattan, where what they did was they sold $20 shares in a CSA from their truck farm. I bought one. I thought it was going to be worth $20. And they delivered my CSA share to my door, and they just handed me. There they are, cutting the vegetables and putting them into a bag for me. It was really fun. And it's on YouTube. I'm in episode 2. school gardens. I'm still in Fairbanks. I thought Fairbanks was amazing. And so this is the school garden outside the middle school in Fairbanks, the most beautiful garden I ever saw. And what they're trying to do is harvest the produce from this garden and then sell it at the farmer's market and raise money for school things. Seemed like a really good idea. The business about school meals is really important these days, and I can't talk enough about why I think schools matter. They set an example. They set standards they're places where kids are learning and learning about life. And there's lots of books about what to do about these. There's Ann Cooper's Lunch Lessons. There's Janet Papendieck's Free for All, which is a polemic about the need for universal school meals. It's coming out in January. And the most recent thing I've gotten is this Student Gardens and Food Service online pamphlet from Bon Appetit Management Company in San Francisco, which is a manual about how to start a garden in a school and how to go all the way from planting the garden, planting the garden, growing the garden, harvesting the garden, and using the produce from that garden in the school lunch program. Very handy. A really nice thing to have, and it's online. So personal responsibility. I think you eat food, not products. You eat smaller portions. You support local farmers when you grow. Grow food at home, cook at home, and teach kids to cook. I do believe that the most radical thing that we could do about food would be to teach kids to cook. On the social responsibility, I think we need to talk about policy. And this is my laundry list of whatever it was we were talking about during the World Cafe. This is my particular laundry list of policies that I'd like to see worked on. Better school food with universal school meals. I'd like to see restrictions on marketing to kids. I think we need a decent food safety system. We have to rethink the whole business about farm supports and tax policies. I'd like to see something done about income equity that would solve the problem of affordability. And then the big ones, campaign financing laws and corporate regulations that are the root of the corruption in our food system. I think this is a really great time to change. We have a first lady and a first family who have planted an organic garden at the White House. And the symbolic value of this, it's not changing the food system, but I think it has a powerful symbolic value. There's a farmer's market across the street from the White House that was opened by the First Lady, a powerful symbolic value. And in fact, we've got a new era in American agriculture. And I will stop here. Thank you very much. Complaints.
I'm really curious about the slide that you had with New York City advertising. I wonder if you can pull that one up again. Especially the counter arguments that were being published by the
Center for Consumer Freedom.
That's the one.
I recommend a trip to their website. They're a very, very interesting group, and why can't I find the thing that opens this up? Okay, I'll just do it that way. They're a very interesting group, and there they are. Can you see that, or do I need to
make it
bigger?
I read it on the right-hand side posters, and it didn't make any sense.
Well,
because what it just seems like what they're advocating is that you're too stupid, and I guess...
Well, you can't read the words that are underneath.
I guess is it a direct response to the idea that they have labeling on the...
I wonder if we can open it up a little bit. Let's see, you're too stupid to make your own food choices, at least according to the food police, that would be me, and government bureaucrats who have proposed fat taxes on foods they don't want you to eat. Now the trial lawyers are thundering into action lawsuits, class action lawsuits against restaurants for serving America's favorite foods and drinks. That's what it says.
I guess it's just, so this is in direct response to the don't drink yourself fat, or is this in response
and the proposals for taxes.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a group that's paid for Well, actually, it's very interesting. It's incorporated as a nonprofit, so that they don't have to reveal their sources of income. But there have been lots and lots of investigative reports about them. And if you go on my website and click on Center for my website is completely indexed. And if you click on Center for Consumer Freedom, it has links to all of the reports that have been done about them. They're an interesting group. They represent the fish industry arguing that methylmercury isn't a problem for people. They represent the tanning industry saying that tanning salons don't cause skin cancer. They have all of those sort of consumer behavior kinds of things. They represented the National Restaurant Association when there were proposals to stop smoking in restaurants. They defended smoking in restaurants, always on personal responsibility and personal freedom grounds. So they're an interesting group. But I think so discredited that I can't imagine that anybody pays any attention to them. Yes? Anybody else? Yes?
There was a short slide about the traffic light system in the UK. And it sounded like you think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I like them.
To know, because I'm very critical about that. We have a lot of discussions about it in Germany. And it's like, I mean, even good olive oil is dark red.
Oh yeah. Well, the issue is the good. Yeah, it's a slippery slope. It's the whole business about rating foods. I mean, if I had my choice, we wouldn't have any labels about health or nutrition on food products at all. If it were up to me, we would just have food, right? I don't know whether we're going back to that, but I see the Smart Choices program as an end run. Because we know that the traffic light system at least stops people from buying some things. Whether, you know, what the choices are and how the choices are made is something that we can argue about forever. I think it's a slippery slope. Where do you draw the line? The minute you say you set up a standard, it can only have 480 milligrams of sodium. What if it's got 479? What's the difference?
Product by good olive oil, right. Like cheap. I mean, they have this kind of substitute with a lot of water in it.
Yeah, it's margarine versus butter. That would be the margarine versus butter argument. I would agree completely. None of these systems is perfect. I don't like any of them, but if we have to have one, I prefer a traffic light. Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions for moving forward on GMO labeling?
I can't hear you.
Do you have any suggestions for how to move forward on GMO?
On GMO labeling? Yeah. I think you need a big consumer push on it. And this is the time to do it. This is a chain. You know, the FDA hired Michael Taylor as the number two person working with Margaret Hamburg at FDA on food safety issues. He's fabulous on food safety. Really, really good, I think. But he was the guy who was the Monsanto graduate who was working at FDA during the time that the labeling decision was made. I mean, this is a chance for him to redeem himself, and I think he should be pushed really hard on it. Because the arguments that the FDA was using don't hold. They just don't hold. One of them was that we don't label foods, we don't label processes on foods. But we do. We say orange juice is made from concentrate. That's a processing issue. So I don't think it works. And they said it couldn't be done. It can be done. If Hershey's candy bars can be labeled that they're genetically modified in Great Britain, they could be labeled here. You know, so give people a choice. I think the consumer choice argument is a very powerful one, and that consumers ought to have a choice. And for that, I think you need to lobby in the way that lobbying takes place. The more, the merrier. In the back?
Hi, thank you. I really appreciated the way that you sort of framed the whole talk as individual decisions and social decisions, sort of that framework. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the relationship between sort of social and political decisions and individual decisions in the food industry.
Yeah, I can't quite hear, but you wanted the relationship between social responsibility and individual responsibility.
Yeah.
Obviously, you need both.
Okay.
obviously. But we live in a society in which the default choices, I think you have to talk about the default. What's the default? The default is to eat what's in front of you. If what's presented to you at a dinner is healthy, and you know, meets nutritional guidelines and does all of that, then you're going to eat it, like we did at dinner tonight, right? If the default is to give you an enormous plate of something that hasn't been made very well and isn't very good quality and has far too much calories and all of the bad things, then you're going to eat that. And so the real question is, how do you make the default something healthy? And in particular, how do you make the default something healthy for people who don't have a lot of money? You've got a choice if you've got money. You can choose to go to a store and buy really nice vegetables and really nice whatever. If you're poor, you don't have that choice. You're buying cheap, the cheapest calories you can get. So how do you change that? That requires social responsibility. So it isn't, I mean, we like to think that we have complete, unfettered, uninfluenced choice about what we eat, but we don't. We eat what's there. You know, our choices are defined by the environment. And, you know, I look around at what's available for me to eat at lunch in the place where I work, or what's in a vending machine, if there are vending machines around. Those are default choices. Every kind of social responsibility. That list of policies that I had, the kinds of lists of policies that came out of the World Cafe, are exactly those kinds of things. You know, you get groups together to work on these kinds of issues to change the environment. And that's what you're trying to do here, is you're trying to make a more sustainable food supply. That's changing the environment to make it easier for people to eat more sustainably. You can't eat locally grown food if there isn't any. You know, I mean, you can't, right? So you want to change land policy so people can grow food locally, and then you can eat locally grown food. These are all political things, and they require social efforts. If you go into a school, you're changing, I mean, that's an easy example. You go into a school and change the school environment, you've already done something incredible for those kids, right? I was taken to schools in Manhattan last week, and I went into a school in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is one of the poorest areas of Brooklyn. And I walked into that school, it smelled good. Somebody was making something for lunch that smelled yummy. And I went into the kitchen, and the place was spotless. The place was set up, the cooks were in there, the food was gorgeous. It was absolutely gorgeous food. And it was jaw-dropping. I mean, this is one of the poorest areas of Brooklyn. And I said to the school food service director, how did this happen? And she said, the staff here really cares. That's all you need. There was a principal who cared. They had a CSA at the school. They raised money so that people in the neighborhood that couldn't afford to join the CSA could get memberships. They raised money, so this was a uniform school. The kids wore white blouses and black pants or skirts. They raised money so that the parents who couldn't afford it could get clothes for their kids. There was a garden at the school. These were poor neighborhood kids. It didn't get any poorer than that. I went to a high school nearby, same food, didn't smell good, didn't taste good, didn't look good, the kids weren't eating it. What's the difference? Nobody cared. The vending machines were open during lunch, totally illegal. I was there with people from the school department, nobody said anything. The vending machines were open during lunch, illegal. Nobody cared. So all you have to do to change a school is have somebody there who cares. That's not that hard to do most of the time. Sometimes it's hard. But there are a lot of people in schools who care. Lots. Yeah?
Could you talk about the effects of genetically modified crops or the latest findings on that?
You know, I can't hear at all. The effects of genetically modified foods on what?
Just the most recent findings. because I can't hear it.
Can somebody screen? Can you?
Curious to hear about the most recent findings on genetically modified crops, because I sense that even if food labeling contained that type of information, that most consumers would not know what to do with it.
What the latest information on what about them? On the effects? I'm not aware of any effects on people's health. I know of a lot of effects on economy, on farmers, on land use, on growth of crops in developing countries. I don't know of any effects on health. Yeah?
I think one reason that people don't know about the effects of genetically modified foods is because they're so well suppressed. If you've seen Deborah Kunz Garcia's film,
I have.
Yeah, and she talks about the scientist whose name escapes me, who was doing the research on GM in Scotland, and when he discovered that there were very severe effects on the test animals, he was effectively silenced. He tried very hard not to be, but his materials were stolen. He was all kinds of things happened. Mm-hmm.
Pushtai. His name was Pushtai.
All right, that ends our talk by Marion Nessel for today. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been Your Homegrown Food, and I'm your host, Jonna, and you can tune in this show every Wednesday from 11:30 to 12. And if you would like to get more information about anything you've heard on this show, you can find it out on my Facebook page, which is Your Homegrown Food Show on Facebook. And you can, you can send me an email with any suggestions for anything you'd like to hear about on the show by emailing me at yourhomegrownfood@gmail.com. Or you can go to my website, yourhomegrownfood.com. So tune in next week for more information about food. And tune this show in every week on Wednesday at 11:30. And I will speak with you all next week. So stay tuned now for Democracy Now! Here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And freakradio.org.
Free Radio has a problem.